Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven. Scott's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, stops by every other month or so to talk about the great outdoors. So, what's going on in your area in the world of wildlife? Give us a call with your questions or comments. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Hi, Larry. It's great to be back. It actually feels like summer out there. It's pretty nice.
I tell you what, we had a run of weather here, though.
It's been really quite unbelievable. I mean, it continued last night. Those storms rolled through, and there were places around the area that got another couple of inches of rain. But it doesn't matter whether you're in southern Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, or up in the North Woods. There's water everywhere.
Yeah.
And we're well off compared to the folks in Arkansas and Oklahoma and whatnot. It's awful down there. But, you know, the water's about 6 feet from the basement windows of my cabin right now up in Price County. And my garden is gumbo here in the southern part of the state. So, yeah, there's a lot of water. That came home to roost when, you know, our friend Ron Eckstein, longtime wildlife manager in Oneida County, spoke to our students at our summer camp last week up in Woodruff, and he's been, since he retired and for the 30 years or so he was working, he kept track of water levels in the wetlands, snowfall, and just general progression of phenology. And he said in all cases, the most water, the most snow since February, and the latest phenology, all those things that he'd ever seen in his time in the North Woods. And, you know, he's a great observer and ecologist. So, you know, there you have it. It's just an unusual year, and things have been very slow to happen, but now they finally seem
starting
to pop.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah. Connie in Portage has a comment or question for you. Let's go there. Connie, hi.
Hi, good morning. I go to Madison at least once a week, and I just came back from there, and I'm worried. From Westfield all the way to Madison on 39 and 90, I've counted at least 12 dead deer, and it's almost like it's the rutting season. I'm so confused. What's going on?
Well, there are quite a few things coming into play, Connie. I mean, for one thing, and I drive that road to and from the aforementioned cabin, I did a count, I don't know, weekend before last, I guess, and I was well over the dozen, but I drove all the way up to Minocqua. Anyway, a couple things. For one thing, the snow finally melted the further north you go, and that revealed winter's accumulation of dead deer, so that is part of the contribution. The deer are also on the move, finally, after being confined by deep snow from the onset of spring until now. They're trucking around the landscape. Plus, with the does, with the mature does dropping fawns, yearlings have been kind of booted out of the mix on their own, and they're moving around the landscape. And when you mix that with lots of cars and holiday travel and all around Memorial Day, that's a bad situation. So,
yeah, most of the deer I'm seeing are yearlings. You can kind of tell.
So there are, there are lots of dead deer. I wish we had some scheme. There have been many over the years to get them at least pushed into the ditch so they're not quite so visible, but at least if they're visible, maybe it gives some people pause to slow down a little bit or keep their eyes open.
But yeah. So there you have it.
Well, it roadkill, not just for deer, but for everything, is a terrible problem, but people are wed to their cars. They're not going. No one's going to stop driving or anything like that. So it's something we just have to deal with by hoping that people display a little caution.
Yeah. There you go, Connie. Thank you so much. Kay in Sauk Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Kay.
Hi. It's kind of a crazy question, but some animal is leaving large, very large deposits in my backyard, and it's about the size of, like, from a 50-pound dog. It's very black. It has no hair or bones in it. And the interesting thing, when I first saw it, I thought, oh, my gosh, what size animal can this be? Because the pile was, like, at least a couple of pounds.
Wow.
Well, I buried that. And a couple days later, I had a new deposit right on top of that same spot. So then I realized what I saw originally were multiple droppings on exactly the same spot. And it has left my area, and it's now doing the same thing in my next-door neighbor. And neighbors said they thought it was a raccoon, except it's very large feces. And what kind of confused me is I have grape jelly, hummingbird feeder, and black sunflower seeds out, and they have never been touched. So what kind of animal does its business on top of previous business?
Well, your neighbor's right. That's pretty common behavior in raccoons. It's referred to as a latrine or an area where they frequently make a deposit. And it could be on a log in the woods or an open spot in your yard or whatever else, and it can accumulate to an impressive volume. So that's certainly part of it. And a good-sized raccoon with a good diet, whatever they happen to be eating, that's a possibility. But scat is not the easiest thing to identify. It's kind of amorphous in structure. Mm-hmm. And if there's nothing diagnostic in the scat, and you said no hair, no seeds, nothing particularly identifiable, that's not much to go on. And if it were coons, I do think that they'd be interested, at least in my yard. They go right for the sunflower seeds. And if I didn't have the grape jelly feeder suspended where no coon, unless it's got a drone, could possibly get to it, I think they would go for that. So some of this may remain a mystery, but I don't think you can rule out raccoon. But if you want to take a look, if you can, either online or find a copy of the book. There's a really nice book called Mammal Tracks and Sign, which includes nice color photos of all possible poop of all kinds.
Yes, and it is a nice book.
It's a really nice book. The author's name is Elbroch, Elbroch, Elbroch. And, you know, you can thumb through the poop pictures and see if you see anything that looks comparable to what you're seeing. But I wouldn't rule out raccoon, even though it seems pretty large.
There you go, Kay. Thanks for calling. Gene in Baraboo, it's your turn. Hi, Gene.
Hi, this is Gene. My question is that recently I saw a doe with three fawn. Someone had told me that usually does will only give birth to two fawn. Someone just recently told me that they can give birth up to four fawn. My question is that I've also been seeing a lot of fawn running around recently alone. And back to the doe with the three fawn, if, say, she only gave birth to one, are doe known for, and I don't know how one could prove it, to adopt or take in fawns that were born from another mother?
Well, they might, but that's the more unlikely explanation. Triplet fawns are not all that unusual. The standard, you're getting good advice from your friends. Two is kind of the normal or mainstay, but it's a distribution. There are quite a few singles. There are lots of twos. There are some threes, not a whole lot, and there can be fours. So all of those are possible, and all are seen with some regularity, but not commonly. And if you wanted I think in probably some of the DNR studies available online, you can probably get the actual percentages, and the number they have also varies a little bit with age. Yearlings, fawns born last year that are bred and have fawns this year, you typically have one. Mature does, again, typically two, but three or four are all possible.
And Gene brings up another point. He mentioned he saw some just on their own, but we were going to talk a little bit about finding a fawn.
Generally, the rule of the day is that a fawn, whether it's found lying in the grass, motionless, trying to avoid any contact with anything, or whether it's up and about and moving through the vegetation, although they may appear to be alone, the odds are greatly in favor of the fact that mom is around somewhere, keeping an eye on things, visiting the fawn when necessary to nurse it and so on. And the rule of thumb, therefore, for human intervention is take a picture or watch its behavior, but give it a wide berth and leave it alone. Don't assume just because it's either lying in the grass alone or moving around or walking through your backyard that it needs your attention, because the odds are much better that it does not. And intervention is not necessarily a good thing.
No, it could go the opposite way.
It could be detrimental to the fawn. And generally, the rule of thumb is leave them alone.
There we go. Thanks, Gene. Appreciate the call. Dave in Wisconsin Rapids, your turn now. Hi, Dave.
Turn off the radio. Hi. I've got more just a general comment on something I've seen several times over the last several years, and that is that I've seen foxes and sandhill cranes like just seem to be enjoying each other's company. And I don't know if anybody else has heard that or observed that or what.
Well, Dave, I have not. You know, Larry and I learned a long time ago on the program to never rule out anything that people might see. And in many cases, something that seems just completely inconsistent with two animals that just shouldn't be in close proximity, there's usually some sort of an explanation, but it's not always obvious. And in this case, by hanging out, you mean, you know, literally the crane standing there and the fox is curled up, you know, in its shadow, or just in the general area? What have you seen?
Well, I've seen two different instances.
Yeah.
One where there was a fox and about two or three sandhill cranes, and the fox seemed to be running around in amongst the cranes, and they just looked like they were having a high old time. And then just here last week, I saw a fox and a sandhill crane come out of a little wooded area, and for all the looks in the world, it looked like they were having a rendezvous in there.
There you go.
I can't give you a good explanation for that, Dave, but
foxes prey on mice and rodents and things like that. Sandhill cranes wouldn't be something they would normally try to get, would they?
Well, not the adults, but the young ones, the colts, would potentially be vulnerable, as would eggs in a nest. You know, if the fox was running around, what we would interpret is, oh, they're all sort of in a big, they're having a grand time looking around at each other and so forth. But if the fox had designs on snatching a crane egg, you know, they would run around and attempt to disorient the cranes or get them disturbed or get them away from the nest so they could dart in and grab an egg. So while it may have looked like fun and games, it might not have been. But
yeah.
I don't know.
Don't know for sure. Dave, thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, our guest today, emeritus professor in the Department of Wildlife Ecology and the University of Wisconsin Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Dave Potratz, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at wildlife in Wisconsin today with our guest, Scott Craven. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. Appreciate it. You can reach us by email, or by phone, I should say, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can do that as well. Certainly love to hear from you. Scott, you mentioned in one of our last calls here, the summer camp that you were involved in. Talk about that, but I think it's a really interesting camp.
It is. It's been great for our students. It's been great for me, frankly. I have a great time being with the students. We started the camp back in 1999 when I was serving for a year as interim superintendent up at the university's Kemp Station on Lake Tomahawk, and we do it every other year for our wildlife majors. And the idea is that we attempt to concentrate on seniors, upper-class students who have had most of our courses, and this is an opportunity to get out into the field and bring together all they've learned about habitat, the animals, ecology in general, and work on a piece of property and come up with a management plan for that property based on what they survey over the course of a couple of weeks. And it's worked out very well. This year, we had a very good group of students. They were energetic, enthusiastic, and in spite of wretched weather, it was
cold and wet.
Oh, God, we had lots of days that we couldn't hardly get out of the mid-40s, and it was wet. But they persevered and really ended up, we had enough nice days interspersed that it worked out. So they do a live trapping exercise, they do bird counts, they do amphibian surveys, they do searches for reptiles, snakes, and whatnot. They survey vegetation, emerging flora, which was pretty darn limited. It was so it was still ice when we got up there. But anyway, despite the difficulties, they had a good year. They found a number of different species of salamanders, including one of conservation concern, the little four-toed salamander. Mm. Those, they're not much bigger than a toothpick, and they worked hard to find those. In their live trapping, they caught, I think, three weasels collectively, and those are very hard for them to catch. There were good numbers of flying squirrels. They found several grouse nests with the hen on eggs, and that was encouraging given all the concern for grouse in the North Woods the last couple of years. And even right around the picnic tables there, and you're familiar with Kemp, there's a dining area, and right at the picnic tables was a big old maple snag there. And we kept hearing a commotion in there, and lo and behold, a pair of pileated woodpeckers nesting in that snag.
Oh.
Like while we're all sitting there eating lunch or dinner or whatever, and they'd call and change as the male went in, the female out, or vice versa, and that was just spectacular. So generally, they saw a lot of neat things. They did a great job on their reports, and a good time was had by all. So I was happy to be part of it. It was fun.
And you were the chief cook and bottle washer as well.
Yeah, among other things. I still help out in other areas, but I started out doing the cooking 20 years ago. This was the 10th anniversary and still doing it. So if nothing else, I've got the menus pretty well figured out.
Right. Well, Marcus in Milwaukee has a question for you. Let's go to Marcus. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
So my question is back to the deer being seen dead alongside the highways. Is there any reason in particular that Wisconsin hasn't attempted to adopt more of like what the western states around some of the national parks have done, where they've built either tunnels under the highway or natural covered like bridges over the highway to facilitate the movement of wildlife from one area to another so that we don't end up with so much dead animals alongside the highway?
Yeah.
Well, it's a good question, Marcus, and there are some areas, particularly in the Canadian Rockies and in the west western part of the United States, where they've made major attempts to create huge overpasses, you know, 100, 200 feet wide, vegetated. But in those circumstances, there are known migration routes, particularly for large mammals, elk and deer and other species, that they can be relatively certain they can either funnel through that area or really want to go that through that particular pass. And it helps that the mountains tend to divert and guide these animals as they move from point A to point B on seasonal migration. As far as the deer are concerned, here in Wisconsin, there are deer everywhere. So it's not feasible to think about building an overpass at tremendous expense because we don't have the natural topography to take advantage of. It would simply be prohibitively expensive and very difficult to position so that it would be effective. In addition, another problem is that wild animals tend to be a little fickle. You know, you can build them a nice overpass, and we have constructed underpasses, say for turtle movements, from a nesting area to where they may be living in the water. We've done that. I think there was an underpass built from one part of the Arboretum to the other, even in Madison, to get under the Beltline. And, yeah, a few animals would use those, but not enough, really, I think, to make people think, wow, this is – now, in the case of turtles, it's a little different. But in general, people would say, whoa, a lot of effort, a lot of money, limited return. And it's kind of like you like bluebirds around your yard, so you go to the store and get this really nice bluebird house and put it up on a nice new post, and here it is. bluebirds, here's a new house for you. And what do? They nest in an old can that you left next to the garden fence. And that's just the way things are. So while it may seem like a good idea from our perspective, getting them to use it, not to mention the cost and difficulty of placement, makes it generally prohibitive.
There are a couple of, I'm trying to think of a story, and it may have relate to salamanders, turtles, or frogs. A couple of communities that have sort of taken it upon themselves to provide help, at least,
yes,
in streets.
If nothing else, the things that are moving highly seasonally, like salamander movements on a warm, rainy night in late February, you know they're going to go tonight, in which case you can get volunteers out, slow down traffic, stand there with a, you know, waving a red flag, or do something productive to get those animals across the road, even to the extent of gathering them up in a 5-gallon bucket on one side, lugging them across and dumping them out on the other side. So there are some cases where people can intervene and make a difference. But in the case of deer in Wisconsin, which are the big visible issue, I don't think there's much we can do in that regard. That's why the deer crossing signs go up when 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 mortalities have been identified in a given spot. The signs go up and, you know, maybe it helps, maybe it doesn't. I don't know.
Marcus, thank you very much for calling. I want to give Bob in Crivets a chance to join us. Bob, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi to you. Yeah, thank you for taking it. I want to ask you guys, have you ever heard something like this happening or seen it? Okay, I lived in the 60s. I'm 73. I lived in the 60s. I was a survival instructor for the military. And then since then, after I got out, I worked for the power and light company. But I've got a cabin up around Crivets here, and I'm always observing animals. And I never saw something like this in my life. I have a problem with my back, so I used to sleep in my recliner, okay, and I got the backyard light on, and I see a red fox come out from under the deck, okay, and then she came up on the deck, and then she took off and came back with some kind of a rodent and took it. She had a den under the deck, okay, and then she brought it back up on the deck about 2 days later, because this one there was 5 of them that she had, okay, and the smallest one was really a runt. And she brought this one up on the deck, and it was dead. Okay, and she had all 4 of them sitting around like you're at a wake. Okay, and one at a time, they all lay down on it, and then they stood back, and then she picked up that dead one. Okay, she went out. We still had snow on the ground. She went out in my woods here, and she buried it. And the following day, she built a new den underneath my cabin. I've got it built on a cement slab. And they never moved back into the other one again. And she's still around here.
Wow.
Okay, yeah,
I never ever saw anything like that.
So one of the kits died. The rest, as far as you know, are still doing okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I know they're doing okay. They moved into a culvert about a quarter of a mile down the road from me. And on my way to the coffee shop in the morning, I usually pull over on the side there just to see if they're nosing around there. Yeah, they're getting pretty frisky now, and they got nice red hair already.
All right, well, good. I'm glad to hear that, because as I read the note on the computer screen here, it led me to believe that they were dying one at a time and they were all dead. But if, the fact that one passed away, that's not unusual. Mortality's high in young animals. If they all survived, we'd be up to our waists in a variety of species. The fact that the female removed it from the den, regardless of what it might look like to us, you know, keeping the den reasonably sanitary and whatnot is part of the female's job. And if we don't know what killed that one, whether there were parasites in there that she was trying to avoid, so she eventually moved the whole litter to another den, or whether something had gotten in there, who knows? But everything you described is pretty standard behavior, and she seems to be doing it right if the other 4 are flourishing.
Doing fine,
so that's good.
Yeah,
thank you for the successful story.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Pat in Minong, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Good morning.
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 I just have a question. The last few weeks we've had a pigeon. I think it's from our research, like a rock pigeon, and he's banded, but he's hanging around the last few weeks and very friendly. Can almost go up and pet him sometimes, but just wondering if he's going to move along or if he, or if he's hurt or retired. I think he might have been a racing pigeon from his band, and the numbers, we can catch the letters on it that start with AU. And my wife did some research and said that might be a racing pigeon.
Yeah.
Well, it probably is, especially if its behavior is obviously it's used to people. It probably came from a loft of whoever's pigeon it was, and it was used to being fed, banded, handled, and sent out on racing or homing activities. Mm-hmm. That's what they do. I had a loft that my neighbor had a loft a few years ago, and his pigeons would occasionally land on the house and we'd see them and so forth. And I had other occasions when I was working as an extension specialist that people would find banded pigeons, dead or alive, and ask, as you are, what the heck do I do about this? And generally, as I started to check into it, the reality was that although some pigeon owners might be curious, you know, what happened to old Charlie, number 21875 or whatever, most of them, as I talked to the pigeon people, said, hey, we don't care. If the bird didn't return, it's a particularly good homing pigeon. And if it fell out of the race or whatever, or was not able to be monitored in any way, it was considered a lost bird, and they moved on. And frankly, they really didn't seem to be overly concerned about it. On the other hand, if you're anywhere near, let's see, you're up in Minong, I ended up doing a little digging and realized that in a larger area like Madison or a larger urban area, there are often pigeon clubs that the people belong to, and they may keep track of the band numbers and so forth, and sometimes their members are curious. If you can explore around a little bit, whatever might be nearby, you might find a club that might lead you to the owner. Beyond that, the only thing I can think of is if you can get the whole number, you know, net the bird, catch the bird, whatever, get the whole number and post a picture or the number on some social media form, you know, who knows? Yeah. It might find its way back. The number may find its way back to the owner, and they say, hey, I'd like to get old Charlie back. And
or then, I'm glad to know.
Or at least I know what happened to it. It never came back. We were been curious. So you can dig as deep as you want, but I'm just setting you up to be potentially a little disappointed at the end if people don't seem too concerned about it.
There you go, Pat. Thank you again for calling. And Dave in Manitowoc, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I got a question about a snake. I was camping last weekend outside of Mauston, and we were on one of the little man-made lakes there from the Wisconsin River, and I caught this snake that was about 3-4 foot long, like darkish colors, tans and browns, but when I caught it, it flattened its neck out almost like a viper would. I'm just curious as to what kind of snakes we have around here that would display behavior like that.
And flatten its head. And when it flattened its head, did it have two dark spots on the back of its head on that flattened area or hood? Could you tell?
I don't remember it.
Okay, so let me back to it. Was it a relative, for its length, was it a relatively fat snake?
Oh, yeah. I would say I could if I could fit my fingers around it, I could just barely touch them together.
In all probability, it was a hognose snake.
Yeah.
And they're really a neat, they're usually in dryish, sandyish areas where they burrow to lay their eggs there. They're a really cool snake in that they're completely harmless. You could hardly get a hognose snake to bite you if you tried. And they have two behaviors. One is that when they're disturbed, they'll flatten out their head, almost like the hood of a cobra. Some people, common names, puff adder, blow snake, cobra, because of that behavior. But they're a completely harmless native snake and reasonably restricted in terms of where they're found in the state. And anyway, if they don't do that threatening behavior, which is designed to say, hey, leave me alone, they go about their business. The other thing they'll do is an alternative. They'll roll over on their back and play dead. kind of coil up, open their mouth, and for all intents and purposes, play dead. And a potential predator, a dog or cat or a kid or whatever, oh, well, it's dead. I'm not going to bother it and leave it there. And then eventually you'll see them pivot their head around, not their body, but their head, and look around and say, oh, the coast looks clear. And then their whole body will slowly turn over and they'll slither away. So it was a really neat snake to see. And in all probability, that's what it was.
Absolutely. Dave, thanks again for calling. It was a good chance to talk about that snake, as a matter of fact, so I appreciate it. Eric and Tomahawk, what's on your mind?
Good morning. I haul propane all over Iron, Silas, and Oneida counties and over Enterprise, and I'm just not seeing the turtles that I normally do, whether crossing the road or sunning themselves on logs. And I don't know if it's just coincidence or I'm not looking quite hard enough or exactly what. I also wanted to mention that lady with the mystery poop, I have a corgi that can come down and identify it, whether it's there or what.
There you go, Eric.
Okay.
Well, where are the turtles? You know, it was a funny spring. Maybe were things set back a little bit for the turtles as well?
Things got started very slowly. I mean, as I mentioned to Larry before we went on the air, that I rescued my first snapping turtle of the year yesterday here in southern Wisconsin. It didn't seem to want any help, but I gave it some anyway, and neither the turtle nor I got run over, so it was pretty successful. In the end of this wildlife camp we were just talking about, I ended up at our cabin over in Price County, and I would say in the last week, the painted turtles seemed to be everywhere. I felled a poplar into a little pond next to the cabin so they'd have a basking log, and I think the most I saw while we were there for 3 days was 17 at a time.
Oh.
One of the neighbors mentioned another log out on the lake that he saw 27 on. So I think things are just delayed, but they're out there, and in places there are a lot of them. And I suspect just literally now, and the DNR just had a press release on this, they're going to be all over the place, crossing roads, trying to find a nesting site. And there was discussion of, you know, how to respond to that as a passerby. We can talk about that a little bit too. But bottom line, Eric, I think if you keep looking, and with this warm weather we're finally getting, I don't think you'll be concerned about turtle numbers.
There you go. And, you might as well comment then on what to do if you do.
Well,
you stopped your car, got off the
road. Well, I actually turned around, looked around, and said, oh, I've got an open spot here. So I pulled a Huey in the middle of the highway and got back there next to the turtle. And it was a pretty good size one, maybe a 10 or 12 pounder. So I scooted along. The first thing to do, if you can stop safely, I mean, don't jeopardize your life or create a possible traffic hazard for a turtle. You know, I'd like to think we always could, or that everybody would stop and let you do that, but some people won't. So be careful, first of all. Then the next thing to do is, okay, which way is the turtle going? If you're going to move it to the side of the road that it was headed for, because it knows what it's doing. Don't put it back where it came from, or it'll just come back out in the road again. So most of them you can pick up carefully by the sides of the shell. Claws may be sharp, but they're not especially dangerous. But what is dangerous are their jaws. So make sure you're out of reach of the jaws. You can carry a snapping turtle by its tail, but it's very quick with that neck and head.
Oh,
and
really
don't
fast.
Dangle it down so they can get you by the leg. I just chose to push it across the road with my foot. They'll usually turn toward you and hiss and snap. Just stay behind it and keep moving it along until you get it off the road and out of harm's way. Don't pick it up and take it home. Just leave it where it was, let it get to its nesting site, and hopefully it makes it across. And frankly, over the last few years, I would say that if I see a turtle in the road, more often than not, before I can get turned around or do something about it, somebody else has stopped and is moving the turtle. So
yeah.
People seem aware of this, and they're tolerant of, uh-oh, turtle, we better slow down. So that's a good thing.
And thanks again for that call. John in Bayfield, we'll turn to you next. Hi, John.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is about bats. I'm on an old family farm, and we've had bats in the attic since my great-grandparents had the place. They disappeared about 2 years ago, and I realized that a lot of our bats were lost to the white nose disease.
Yeah.
And is there any chance that I'll get a new colony coming back? You know, I'm sure that was a generational colony.
Yeah, it's a sad state of affairs.
It is a very sad state of affairs, as Larry says. And I think there are a couple of things to think about, John. What you're seeing is the aftermath of white nose syndrome finally making its way into Wisconsin. It was anticipated. It was discovered in 2014. It was discovered nationally in 2006 in upstate New York. And it's killed millions of bats. And it's killed a lot of bats here in Wisconsin. Most of the roosts have declined. I think the DNR figures are something like 72 to 97%, some of them virtually wiped out, like your colony. They didn't necessarily die there in the farm because that was likely a summer roost, but they perished at their winter hibernaculum and just never made it back to the farm. The other thing to consider is that these, for little animals, small animals, these guys are very long-lived. You know, 10, 20 years of age for some of these bats, not uncommon. And therefore, seeing a colony like yours wiped out, it's going to take a while for that kind of thing to recover. Now, the good news is that there are a lot of people working on this. There seem to be some vaccines that may have some promise. There may be other help. And maybe in time, you know, bats evolve. Bottom line is it's going to take a while. But in the meantime, and I'm glad you brought this up because we wanted to talk about it anyway, the DNR has a very good and very effective and competent bat team working on this whole problem. They're doing just about everything they can think of. And right now, the BAT team is promoting a Help the Bats campaign, and they're looking for volunteers to report barns like yours, farms, bat houses, any roosts where surviving bats show up, even if it's only a couple. And these can be reported to dnrbats@wisconsin.gov. And what they're looking for is areas where there are still a few bats returning. For example, if all of a sudden 10 or 20 showed up at your farm, John, they'd like to know that because these may be sites where those bats could then be treated if there is a vaccine and comes available.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Or at least they know where there are still a few remaining bats that they can keep track of and see what their fate may be. So a place like yours could be very important, John, but I urge anybody who still has a few bats coming back to their bat house or attic or whatever to report that to dnrbats@wisconsin.gov and let the bat team know where they are because
Absolutely.
There are a lot of places like John's that just don't have them. We always had one of the things at the summer camp we were talking about was bat night. And there were lots of bats in the old buildings there at Kemp. We could always catch a few, and they would mark them with light sticks or use their acoustic recorders. The students had a great time with the bat team members. We could not find bat one while we were there this time around. So anyway, there's a chance for everybody to get involved to help out, but the situation is not good.
Perilous, that's for sure. John, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or phone in at 1-800-642-1234. Scott, we got an email from Daniel. He sent a nice photo of a fisher. Like you to comment on population and distribution of fishers in Wisconsin. He lives in north central Pierce County and have had one hanging around for a couple of years in his neck of the woods.
Well, it's another nice segue because one of the very popular and high-profile projects in Wisconsin right now is Snapshot Wisconsin, the trail camera program that's now gone statewide in the last couple of years, and they're getting gazillions, that's a very technical term, lots of pictures from cooperators. And in their newsletter just a couple of days ago, they featured the Fisher. And there were some wonderful trail camera pictures like this one. This is a pretty nice photo.
That's a nice one.
That Daniel sent in, but there were many of them. And they featured the Fisher and how they were gleaning information to address the questions that Daniel asked, which is, hey, how many of them are there and how are they distributed? And they had a very nice map showing, ooh, there's a lot of photographs up here, not so many here, relatively few in the southern couple of tiers of counties. But the short, so bottom line is, Daniel could access that on the DNR website. If they, Snapshot Wisconsin has their own website, and that recent newsletter, which comes out periodically, featured the Fisher. That, I think he'd find that very interesting. But in general, since their recovery or restoration, you know, must be close to 50, 60 years ago now, early on after their recovery, they were extremely numerous in about the northern third of the state and seemed to kind of overshoot the mark, so to speak, as populations that are released into a novel environment tend to do. And they've actually tailed off a little bit in recent years in the north, but have been moving south. And there are quite a few pictures of them down into, well, I had a really nice picture that someone sent in a few years ago from Governor Dodge State Park over here to the west of us. Another one in Columbia County. Those are the outliers, but certainly they've moved into most of the northern two-thirds of the state.
And there you
Daniel's
go.
Daniel's got one there in the backyard. But I urge anybody interested in the Fisher situation to get that recent issue of the Snapshot Wisconsin newsletter, and I think they'll enjoy the pictures and the generated information.
Terry in Roberts asked about large numbers of frogs crossing roads in summer at night when it rains. She doesn't see this anymore. She used to see it. Are their numbers really low?
Some of the big, the frogs that were usually seen in huge numbers like that were primarily leopard frogs. And they've had some disease problems and development problems and a variety of other things over the years. So some of the huge migrations may have dwindled a little bit, but there are certainly leopard frogs still out there. But as she points out, probably not in the huge numbers that they may have seen years ago.
Chuck in Sturgeon Bay has something for us. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I have a question related to pileated woodpecker.
Sure.
I've lived in central Wisconsin for 40 years in a wooded area and had experience to see pileated woodpeckers in the wild there maybe 6 to 8 times a month over that 40-year time. 5 years ago, I retired and moved to Sturgeon Bay and live in an area where we see pileated woodpeckers on almost a daily basis. During those 45 years, they, of course, have all been the typical black, white, and red color. In the past 1 year, I have seen an adult female in our immediate area who is silver gray and white and red, exactly the same coloring distribution as the normal pileated woodpeckers, but silver gray in place of the black. Do you have any comment about that?
Well, it's probably a very pretty bird. That would be one comment.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
I really enjoy pileated woodpeckers, no matter what color they are. They're a great bird. They have a great call, and they're big and spectacular. They're kind of the Woody Woodpecker of the bird world. But like all birds or any bird, they're susceptible to variations in color, usually genetically related, but sometimes some pigment deficiency. And my guess would be whether it's partially leucistic or a pigment problem with the black pigment or whatever. This bird, like, oh, in Outdoor News the other day, there was a great picture of a robin that had a variety of scattered white feathers.
Yeah.
And there are untold variations like that. And I never know the actual reason, but there are a couple of genetically based reasons why you get different pigmentation issues. But it's the first time I've ever heard of that variation in a pileated.
Yeah,
so
interesting.
You're lucky to be close to pileateds in general. And if you've got an unusual one to keep your eye on, you at least have an individual that you can track over the years. So keep up the good work, Chuck.
Thanks, Chuck. Appreciate it. Glenn in Fox Lake has a question. Hi, Glenn.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard on the news maybe yesterday about someone or some group has filed lawsuits, and they think that the lake sturgeon is there's not very many of them, and they're talking about maybe putting them on the endangered list. I don't know if Scott has heard that.
Well, no, Glenn, I've not heard of that particular request, but I mean, it doesn't surprise me. There are groups, you know, especially when you have a rather unusual or high profile animal, there are always groups that may take issue with how they're managed. But all I can say in response to that is our lake sturgeon populations, you know, especially in the Winnebago system where spearing is such a big deal, that sturgeon population and the Wolf River and the spawning run and everything else related to lake sturgeon is as intensively and carefully and professionally managed as any fish population I could think of.
Yeah.
So I don't see that there's a lot of room there for criticism. I mean, they're a long-lived old fish. But they're well taken care of. There's a strict quota. They keep a close eye on what's happening. They protect them religiously when they're on their spawning run. I can't imagine that there's a problem, Glenn, and if somebody's concerned about that, hopefully they'll find something more productive to spend their time on.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you very much for calling. That's probably the most well-researched and studied fish of any that I can think of here in Wisconsin, for sure. Linda in Minocqua, it's your turn.
Good morning.
Hi.
I was wondering if you have any suggestions on what to do to protect the turtle eggs once they're laid to keep the predators off of them.
Yes, and thank you for bringing that up, Linda, because when we talked about digging turtles or saving them out in the road, I was going to say something about nest protection. But in any event, let's say a turtle, painted turtle, snapping turtle, whatever turtle decides it's going to lay a nest in your lawn or your flower bed or along the cut bank on your driveway or whatever. First of all, leave them alone until they finish. They're pretty single-minded when they're laying eggs, but give them a wide berth and watch carefully where they're digging, because once painted turtle, for example, the middle of the lawn is done and covers the nest back up and pats it down, it's not that easy to find anymore, which is the whole idea. So mark carefully where it is and then build a nest cover, essentially like a cloche in your garden, usually made out of chicken wire, not hardware cloth, the mesh is too small, but at least chicken wire would be the smallest, and maybe 1x2 or 1x3 welded wire would be even better to form a rigid frame. And the recommendations are a cover 16, 18 inches by 16 or 18 inches and 8 or 10 inches high. What you're essentially making is a dome. And then center the nest underneath the dome, trench it in a little bit so it's firmly, you know, something can't go under it easily, and then stake it down. And the best thing for that are landscape staples, which you'd get to put down landscape fabric or plastic or whatever. They're about 4 inches long, look like a giant staple. And you put 3 or 4 of those around the edge of your cover, make sure it's tightly adhered to the ground, and leave it alone. And then when the young turtles emerge, they can pass through that mesh very easily, and they're off on their own. But presumably the local raccoon, possum, skunk, or other nest predator cannot defeat your dome, and the turtle nest is safe.
There you go.
There you have it. Good
luck. Thanks, Linda. Appreciate the call. Jess in Gills Rock, what's on your mind?
Hi, guys. How are you? I've noticed in May and June up here that during broad daylight, there's porcupines, and they're stumbling down the center of the road like they're drunk. And it goes on for a couple of months at the beginning of the summer, and then it stops.
All right, so I'm trying to think of what berries and so forth are in season right then.
Yeah, it seems early. I mean, some animals that consume large quantities of fruits that have fermented a little bit do, in fact, become a little tipsy. And but porcupines are not known for that. They're primarily gnawers and bark eaters, yeah, and so forth. So I'm more likely to think of it as especially early in the season if it's got something to do with the mating season. They're not a particularly graceful animal anyway. They kind of lumber along. They're slow moving. And I think any porcupine meandering down the road is going to look a little bit odd compared to something that's, you know, sleek, graceful, and fast like a fox. Porcupines can't lay claim to any of those traits. And they do when the breeding season is on. They're a little awkward, and they make some strange sounds and whatnot. So, I mean, that's another possibility. But I don't think that the drunken behavior is likely, and it's frankly not something I've seen or heard about before. So
there you go. Thanks, Jess, for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, our guest today, he will be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. Talking wildlife here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Scott Craven, emeritus professor and extension specialist from the Department of Wildlife Ecology, Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Join in, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. And Cheryl in Conover has something for us. So let's go to Cheryl. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had to share with you, when the gentleman was talking about the pileated woodpecker, I have a yard full of wonderful birds, but the most important of my birds, I have a pileated, and this year, for the very first time in 20-some years, I have a full red-headed woodpecker that comes every night at 3 o'clock, or every afternoon at 3 o'clock, and we have the hairy woodpecker and the downy woodpecker. And I have 7 pairs of grosbeaks.
Wow.
Which one? Rose-breasted or evening?
No, the rose-breasted grosbeaks.
Yep, those are
really pairs.
Those are really pretty.
Absolutely beautiful. All 7 of the males come in, and then all 7 of the females come in. And this morning, I normally put on my windows those decals to keep them from hitting the windows. Well, one of the juvenile grosbeaks, which is a male, but it's not rose-breasted yet, and you can tell it's a juvenile, hit the window this morning and wound up in my cilantro pot. And he was so pretty, and I said, "It's okay, Mr. Grosbeak. You're going to be okay in 25 minutes. I just know it." And he sat there real still, and then his head moved a little, and then his little feet moved a little, and in about 25 minutes, he flew away. But I just can't tell you how the birds this year have just blossomed in the North Woods. I've never seen that many pairs of grosbeaks and the woodpeckers. And then we got orioles in this year, too. 2 sets, 2 males, 2 females.
Cheryl, you are a lucky gal.
Sounds like you've got a great backyard.
I'm so lucky. You have no idea. It's been just the highlight of coming back from the south and coming back up north and seeing all these birds show up this year. I'm just ecstatic.
Well, enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Friend of mine, Roger Korfmacher, he and his wife live in northern Wisconsin, and he sent a video of the birds, the hummingbirds, around his 2 hummingbird feeders, and there had to be 40, 50 of them.
Wow.
And he goes through a gallon a day.
Holy mackerel. That's a lot of birds the size of your thumb sucking down sugar water. Holy mackerel.
A gallon a day right now. And I'll tell you, the video was just spectacular to see.
Pretty neat.
It was pretty cool.
Pretty cool.
Well, thanks to Cheryl, let's go to Steve in Boulder Junction. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Last weekend, there were five young fishermen up on a lake in Washburn County. Experienced young guys are accustomed to identifying fish, and they said they're in a 60-acre lake that's about 30 feet deep. There's no inlet or outlet. It's very clear, and they swear they saw a 4 to 5 foot long sturgeon. Is it possible that a sturgeon would live in a lake like that?
Yeah.
Well, I thought anything's possible. You know, who knows how it got there? Somebody might have thrown in a small one just to see what would happen, or who knows? But yes, it could probably survive. You took the wind out of my sails when you said no inlet or outlet, because I had an experience myself quite a number of years ago where a very large lake sturgeon from Lake Mendota had gone up a small feeder stream and ended up at high water over a beaver dam, and I discovered it while I was canoeing in a relatively shallow wetland, and at that point the sturgeon was pretty much trapped. So it was certainly a place where I didn't expect to see it, but the circumstances there were the sturgeon able to move in or out from a larger body of water, and that doesn't seem to be the case in this lake. Yes, it's possible. Could they have mistaken it for something else? Boy, I don't know what when you get to that size, other than a really big muskie. There's not much else in there that could be that size.
Yeah,
so
that's right. And frankly, I've observed in small lakes, pretty small lakes, maybe not 60 acres, but 120 acres. I know there are, and with no inlet or outlet, and I've observed sturgeon when I was musky fishing in those waters. So, you know, sometimes I think you're right, Scott. Maybe somebody gets one or a couple and throws them in there.
We'll never know. Bottom line, Steve, it's certainly possible.
Jim in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Oh, thanks for being there.
You bet.
I have a brief story about a soft-shelled turtle, or two of them, actually. When I was a kid, we used to go on turtle hunts, and there was a place where the river had changed its mind, so to speak, and there were all these hollow stumps, and turtles would sun themselves on them, and we would sneak up in a rowboat and scare them, and, you know, usually three or four would jump inside the stump, and we would harvest them, so to speak, and let them run around in the bottom of the boat. And one of them that we caught was a soft-shell turtle, you know, skin on the shell.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It was about 4 inches in diameter, and I thought I'd never seen one before. And so I decided I was going to take this one home as a pet. And I made the mistake of sticking my tongue out at it. And it took the bait, so to speak.
Oh, boy. Ouch.
Little notch out of the tip of my tongue, and sat there and kind of glared at me as it chewed.
Oh, jeez. Well, soft-shell turtles are notorious biters, and they're not very pleasant to handle, but they're a really neat animal. They almost look like they're molded out of rubber from one of these machines in the arcade where they mold a toy animal for you when you put your quarter in. But they really get pretty large, Jim, so you're lucky it wasn't a big one. Or you might have a bigger divot in your tongue.
You had an experience with one that was pretty good size, Scott?
Yeah, soft-shell turtles are generally, there are two kinds, spiny soft-shell and smooth or brown soft-shell. They look pretty similar except for spines on the front top of the shell. But they're really creatures of big water for the most part. Wisconsin River, bigger lake systems, bigger river systems, and they can really get huge. I mean, bushel basket size. And the issue is people just don't see them very often. They don't move very far from the water to nest, and they don't really bask very much like the other turtles, like painted turtles. So all they do is stick their little pig-like snout out of the water and to breathe, and that's about all you see of them. Well, anyway, when you've been around at this as long as I have, you have a variety of stories, and people were always bringing me things at the university. And in one case, it was a soft-shell turtle that somebody found along the path around Lake Monona. It was dead, and they thought it was unusually large, which it was. But the likely fatal cause of its problem was most interesting. It was a large pair of men's underwear, which the turtle had apparently crawled, somehow got in the lake, but the turtle went through the waistband, which was quite large, but tried to exit through a leg opening, which wasn't. And it got all entangled in this bit of cloth, and I think that eventually impeded its ability
to breathe,
eat, swim, breathe, or whatever, and it died. And anyway, they brought me the whole situation, the huge turtle entangled in the underwear, and I think I've got a picture of it somewhere, but that was kind of a unique situation. But the point being, they really do get very large, and they have a nasty disposition. So don't mess with a big one if you come encounter with it, or you'll end up like Jim and... Don't stick your tongue out at it. Okay, moving on.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the story. David, Oneida County, it's your turn.
Yes, Larry, thank you for accepting my call.
Sure.
And Scott, you're a great guest. I love to hear you talk. I just wanted to ask you one thing about crossbreeding. Up here in Oneida County, I've been feeding birds, and there's two smaller variety of squirrels come, the flying squirrel and the little red squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
And the red squirrel is still larger, of course, than the flying squirrel, but I've been seeing a squirrel in the porch rail every now and then, and to me, it looks like it's been crossbred between a flying squirrel and a red squirrel. Is this possible?
Why do you think it's crossbred?
Well, normally the flying squirrels don't have any red on them, and they're quite small. They've got that little side stripe that shows their white stomach and all.
Mm-hmm.
But the red squirrel, these look a little bigger than a normal flying squirrel, and they have a little...
What?
Oh, we lost.
Not as red as what the red squirrel would have, and they still have that little side stripe with the white tummy.
Okay, what about their tail? Do they have the big flat tail that a flying squirrel typically has?
The only difference is when they seem a little bigger as a whole, and the tail has a little bit of reddishness.
Okay, well,
a flying squirrel doesn't have that.
So there's another explanation, Dave, and that is that, first of all, flying squirrels, of which there are two species, and red squirrels, are entirely different species. Crossbreeding would be
impossible,
or certainly that just wouldn't happen. But among the flying squirrels, in Oneida County, the most common one now is the southern flying squirrel. They're small, and what you're generally describing is being around your feeder. Kind of a light beige, light brown in color, white belly, snow white belly, and a little bit smaller than the red squirrels. Okay, but there's another flying squirrel that's been largely displaced by the smaller southern flying squirrel, and that's the northern flying squirrel, which can be half again or almost twice as big as the southern flying squirrels. They're darker in color, a little more reddish-brown, and their belly, if you get a chance to look at its belly, the hairs are white on the tip and gray close to the body. So that's the easiest way to tell a northern from a southern. But rather than try and attribute some weird hybrid between two species that shouldn't interbreed, I think you're lucky enough to maybe have a northern flying squirrel there. Yeah. There are still populations of them around, but they're really hard to find. So if you can get a look at its belly and it's got gray, the part of the hair up close to the body, then that's a good find. And if you can get a picture of it, I'd kind of like to see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's a better, a more plausible explanation than the really weird hybrid.
If you get a picture, send it to me and I'll forward it on to Scott. at just Larry Mueller Show at WPR.org. You can find my address and how to contact me. Scott, I wanted to mention the Culverts Project because I understand there's still a couple of openings. Maybe talk about what it is and how people can get involved.
Yeah, the Culverts Project, Larry, is a landowner education empowerment program that we being our extension team in the wildlife program, have been running since the mid-1990s. There are one or two workshops a year. Most have been, although they've been around the state, most are now at the Kemp Station that we talked about earlier. Beautiful place to get people together. We usually look for about 25 committed woodland owners to participate every year. And the program is offered at no cost to the landowners. It's underwritten by a couple of grants. And we bring the landowners in there on a Thursday, and they're with us until midday Sunday. And in the course of those 4 days, they're well-fed, well-housed, and immersed in a whole series of activities from fireside chats to field tours to lectures to a whole host of things, all designed to make them not only better stewards of their own land, but we're looking for people who are willing to carry the word about sound forest stewardship out to other neighbors, friends, other people in the community. So it's an application process because we're looking for, you know, a certain motivated type of landowner. And if that piques somebody's interest, you need to own woodland parcel, not necessarily hundreds of acres. Smaller parcel is fine as long as you kind of have this spark to enhance your property and help other people enhance their property for the benefit of sound forestry and sound wildlife management. So this year it's occurring in mid-August. At the Kemp Natural Resources Station outside Minocqua. I think the dates are the 11th to 15th, give or take a day or so. And then, so to find out about this, the way to go about it is to Google or search on your computer Wisconsin Coverts Project, C-O-V-E-R-T-S. It's an English term for grouse cover. A little patch of brush. Anyway, search Wisconsin Coverts Project. That will get you to the application and contact information for Jamie Knack, our outreach specialist who runs the program. And I'll be doing the cooking for that one, too.
No.
So it's a chance to sample the fare from summer camp. Anyway, mid-August, up at Kemp Station, no cost to the woodland owner. It's a great program.
That's wonderful.
We've been at it for 25 years, and it's just been a great program. So if you're interested, go find that application on Wisconsin Coverts Project and let us hear from you.
There you go. Well, Hannah has a dilemma, I think, in Ellison Bay that she wants to ask about. Scott? Hannah, hello.
Hello. I'm calling because I have a porcupine that is eating my stairs, and I have tried to spray him or her fluid that contains garlic, white pepper, and peppermint, and it doesn't seem to bother him at all. I have finally put all kinds of equipment in front of my stairs so that he won't go over them and come up and eat my stairs, but he has managed to eat quite a bit of the wood, and I would like to know if you have any good suggestions for me.
Well, there are a number of possibilities, Hannah. The first and most direct is if you think it's only one porcupine, they're not that difficult to catch in a large live trap or have someone do it for you and bait it with apples or something like that that they'd be attracted to and just remove the animal, put it somewhere else. That's the most direct approach. The repellent approach that you've been trying, I'm not sure where you came up with that garlic pepper mix. Maybe that's a home remedy, but there are some commercial repellents that bird feeding stores often carry or garden centers that are based on the active ingredient in hot pepper sauce, which is called capsaicin, and a good heavy dose of that. And I can't imagine that porcupine would keep gnawing on the stairs. And the other issue, if this is a seasonal thing or you just want to end it once and for all, either with a band of hardware cloth, woven wire, or sheet metal, either of which are readily available, that could just be bent around the tread on the step and tacked in place, and they couldn't do any damage. So there are some possibilities there to think about depending on what you want to do.
And there you go. Thanks so much, Hannah, for calling. Appreciate it. Scott, I wanted to also mention some volunteer opportunities that are out there for people, too.
Yes, there are a bunch of them, Larry, and many are part of the Wisconsin Citizen Monitoring Program or effort. It used to be kind of called the old Citizen Science Initiative, where people could participate in professional activities and contribute to the database we have in the state on a lot of things. So there's a new bumblebee brigade. You know, there's a lot of concern over native pollinators and particularly native bees. The DNR is running a bumblebee brigade, and there are training sessions around the state all through June. We mentioned the Help the Bats program earlier, and that's really an important one. If you're seeing any bats, report those to dnrbats@wisconsin.gov. There are also, I think, the fawn search volunteering with the DNR's deer research programs ended either today or yesterday, so that may be over with, but that's another thing to think about next spring. And there are just a ton of other opportunities. You can volunteer to serve on one of the CDACs, the Citizen Deer Advisory Committees. There's lots of opportunity there. There are plenty of plans in the works that citizens can have input on. The trout plan is out. The bear plan has been out for a while. And comments on that one may be closed. I'm not sure. But the bottom line is, excuse me, with a little digging around on the DNR's website, if you're interested in doing things, and the Snapshot Wisconsin program we mentioned earlier with the cameras, all kinds of opportunity in your normal activities outside to collect information that will help in the management of all sorts of Wisconsin species.
Yeah, so, that's...
anyway.
Yeah, and one quick one. Someone was wondering about the resting state of hummingbirds. Do they have a resting state?
Well, they don't rest very often, but they do, just simply sit. I've got several that are using the hummingbird feeder in the front of the house, but invariably when we're having dinner and look out the window, I've got a wire frame for my pole beans in the garden. Mm-hmm. A 90-foot panel of hog wire that's just sticking up in the air, and there's not a day goes by that the hummingbird is not, if he wants to sit, that's where he goes. And he sits up on that wire with a panoramic view of the garden, and he just sits there. So, you know, like any other bird taking a break, I guess. So, yes, they do take a break occasionally, and of course, at night they go to roost, and then they sit and sleep. So they
do rest.
They do. when you're as active as hummingbird, you better rest once in a while, or you're going to run out of gas.
Scott never runs out of gas. Scott Craven, our guest today, a wildlife ecologist. He's an emeritus professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and the University of Wisconsin Extension. Always great to have him come by. And he's coming back you'll be back next month as well.
Yes.
The first Wednesday of the month. So we can look forward to that again as well. Tomorrow we'll be talking about scams with our folks from the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. That's at 11 o'clock and running right up to 12:30. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening and for all the great calls. And please stay with us because there's a whole lot more here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mehler.